welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Stuart Broughton, sales manager at Monitor Magazine. He tells us some of the things that went on at BFM's publishing arm, and also describes some of the pitfalls of being in events management and artist representation in the early 90s. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Stuart Broughton.
Oh, hello.
Now, to start at the beginning, what year was it you came to BFM, and what were the circumstances surrounding that?
I think it was 89, but I was working at Charlie Gray's Pictures Theatre, where I was right-hand man to Charlie, and it was just a bit of everything, doing publicity. And I left there, and I must have been, I think I was about 21, so I think it's early 89 or some months into that. And Simon Lahn gave me a job, actually.
What were they looking for?
Sales guy for Monitor. Right. Yeah. Well, because I was a listener of BFM, etc. I always used to come up here to sort the Charlie Gray's ads out, and sort of had this acquaintance.
Right. So you were aware of the Book of Biffham, which was the predecessor for Monitor?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I don't know if it just changed names. It was certainly just recently called Monitor when I came on. And selling ads, which I wasn't any good at. apart from just making an effort and trying to get people, hustling people, I didn't really come from a sales thing, and I haven't ever gone back to a sales. I had to sell ads in it, and I'm kind of uncomfortable even thinking about that. But you had to take an interest in the whole magazine, and I from the distribution to everything, and promoting it, really. And I think that's probably where my greatest strength lied. And just trying to make this magazine carry on and make budget. It was at a time where, I don't know, the whole youth marketing thing wasn't even there, I don't think. I seem to recall we had one advert from a ad agency that was for rum with, I don't know, pelicans or toucans on it or something like this. And there was nothing else, And the advertising agencies didn't, they didn't have anything relative to the market. It took ages before they even came up with a Levi's ad or something like that, Looking back at it, the magazine was a strange thing to have.
For a radio station, for
It was sort of a bit confusing for some people, but I think when you look back at it in context of how the internet works now for something like BFM, that it ticked all the same boxes and achieved a lot of the same potentials. Primarily, it was a mouthpiece for BFM.
For the radio station.
And it promoted it.
Yeah.
And it backed it all up. And if you had an interesting guest up here, well, it was easy to do an interview in print as well.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
There was also Crackham, of course, but I mean, that have always been on their own thing. I landed in the job and was suddenly sat next to Paul Cassidy. I didn't know what I was doing. We had one word processor, which was forever taken up by people sort of doing reviews and people sort of finishing their papers and essays, university. Yeah. Philip Wong Toy, I remember well, having to queue up for using the one computer, and that probably leads to just where it was technologically in even just 89, that this was a magazine put together by Bromide. Like in a year or two later, we started to get an Apple Mac just to output some text to cut into it and things like that. But I think it was kind of like this pioneering time of a lifestyle magazine, and that's pretty much what it was. It was it was a lifestyle magazine.
Who was the editor?
Paul Cassidy. I think that was one of the main strengths of it, not just with him, but the next editor too, Michael Lamb, who brought an amount of irreverence to it, of a sense of humour. you pick it up and you look at it, and some of it's pretty funny today. Doesn't take itself too seriously. It wasn't run from BFM. It became a kind of it's self-regulating thing. I'm sure on occasion it even criticised BFM. So you'd arrange a record review as well, and then the record review, I think it happens in Michael Lamb's case, I can remember it well enough. I think it was Tanita Tikkatram, something like that.
Tanita Tikkatram.
It sounded like a chicken farting. And, of course, the big page ad next door to it didn't really work out for the record company. I can't stand that sort of thing. The whole bullying of that sort of situation, and I was, if anything, quite proud of that magazine for the anti, well, the balance it took with its advertising. It wasn't this sort of great big commercial sellout thing, and I enjoyed that part of it. It was this quite strange situation, sort of orbiting BFM. And that's pretty odd. And it got odder. Paul Cassidy left, then Michael Lamb took over, which he wanted to take it somewhere. And he took it downtown to Turners and Growers, where he had arranged free rent. And we had these offices down there. And, it was very, very interesting. In a lot of ways, it flourished, really. So I'm going to introduce a track now from the period. Stone Roses, Fool's Gold.
Show me love.
I stumbled across this bar that looked all right. It was New Year's Day. I was walking back from a party.
What year?
New Year's 91.
Day? Wow.
91, yeah, it would have been. And sometimes that New Year's Eve party after the turn of the decade is even bigger for some reason. You think people get overrated or overhyped. And it was a big party, and I was walking back in the hot sun, and I thought, well, I've got to have a beer on my way home, which was Fleet Street, Newton. And there was this pub, the Dog and Trumpet, on the corner of K Road, and I went and had some beer. You know, one thing led to another. I was talking to the bar guy, and he says, oh, do you have bands? Oh, we've got this room down the back. And that is what I took on as the Dog Club.
Is what's now the Dog's Bollocks.
Well, that's right, yeah. But it was only a little sort of appendage to this whole big pub that had been there forever and a day. It was probably called something else. I forget what it's called. One of these sort of rough old corner places. But then I think the Dog and Trumpet incarnation was a modern sort of bistro type deal. And I was talking to the guy, and I said, well, what do you do with it in the weekends? Not much. And it's amazing, you know, it's like this little chapel thing. And I says, well, I'll take it off, I'll try and put some stuff in. And I didn't really mean it to go that far, and he did, you know, he'd have stuff midweek maybe. And I don't know really how it got rolling, but it just rolled, and it just went sort of crazy with people ringing up just wanting a gig. And I put a line up to start with, and I think my band was on it, but there was a whole bunch of others. And it just went from there, really. And it started, something like the beginning, maybe late January 91, and it was called the Dog Club. It lasted for 6 months. Well, Supergroove did a lot of gigs there, their first gigs, as did a few other people. You know, Mutton Birds, I think, was their first gigs. And halfway through that, I had to leave Monitor. I couldn't do it justice, and I was pushed. And that was fine, and that was it for Monitor, really. I kind of moved on, and I started managing Supergroove.
Did Monitor get another sales rep and carry on?
Yeah,
or was it,
yeah. It lasted another month after I left. Okay. Yes, so well, there you go. Yeah,
so there you
no,
go.
No, there was a. It got canned, and I thought that was a shame. Really, I thought it was. It had something, and BFM left it to other people, that publishing thing, and that was that. Mm. And then happily the internet came along. Let's go, Gary Clail, Human Nature. There's something wrong with human nature.
Intolerance. sleeping rough on the streets. Sometimes people do the strangest things.
Now we're getting into super groove. So this is that's the next thing that came along, isn't it?
Yeah, and how do I relate that back to BFM? Took on a lot of bands, and for this club I worked with, and was fine with all these Flying Nun bands, and you know, some of it's a bit more earnest than others. And but I like the potential in that. You know, I like the idea of it, especially when you go back and listen to that old super groove stuff. One thing I did like about it was the irreverence of it, and that was fun, and that's what I went for. And I'm in some ways regret the time I spent with it now, because I spent 4.5 years at it. I regret what it did to my career.
You regret it?
Yeah, I don't care. I don't think it taught me as much as 4.5 years of doing anything else would have taught me. It was a really hard time. I have to say, I was the only one funding it, you know. I was the only one taking that initiative, and we couldn't get the first recordings on radio, you know, and this is as cheesy as it gets. BFM did play the stuff, and they did. I'm not sure if they would have taken them seriously, but they got on, they endeared themselves to BFM, and BFM played their music, an introductory single that kind of worked out, Here Comes the Supergroove, and then the next single, which we pinned all our hopes on, Got to Know, and already done a national tour for the other one, and then I did the Got to Know tour, 3 weeks of national touring, 3 shows a day, most days. And that single broke through. Got to Know went gold, which was tremendous. I mean, I was really proud. I mean, and then I started getting, oh, I better get a contract, you know, better get a...
With the band themselves.
Yeah. And that's where it all went bad, you know. Mm. It just went really, really bad. Because I got a lawyer. He took it to them. They took it to a bloody real estate lawyer or something. And it all just blew up. My lawyer became their lawyer. And they said, you're fired. I mean, I had to stay on, right? They said, well, here's the deal. You stay on with this. I basically carried on, but without the executive control. And obviously taking advice from all these wankers. And I stayed on for another 2.25 years until they split. And I was happy when that ended. Yeah, that's what happened. They went on a world trip, which was, you know, that was fine. You know, great. A promo trip. And I read a New Zealand musician these days that they had an international career. Well, I don't know about that. But they were very popular in New Zealand. And when they came back from the tour, they made a decision, Carl and so, they were going to change the lineup and they wanted to take a new direction. Well, that was fine. And actually, Shay sat down with me to talk about taking on his thing. You know, Chains had just come out and we sat up there at the cafe on K Road and talked about it, but he didn't sort of get back to me on that. DLT thing was a great collaboration. I think that's, you know, everything that Shay needed at the time. It was a little disingenuous of BMG to put it out before Supergroove's record. It was a bit odd and it was wrong. I read later an article with Shay Fu about why he left and all of this. This is before the reunion. Well, why did you get kicked out? And the interviewer comes up with some idea that it was racial tension and he agrees with it. So I'm sort of disappointed with that. You know, I think that's wrong. There was no racial thing when Shay was in the group and there was no racial motivation for leaving it. But when a journalist asks the question like, so you're kicked out for being a brown boy, and he doesn't dispute that. I think that's ridiculous. And I particularly didn't like the reunion of Supergroove when the first publicity piece came out and said, it was a quote here, we didn't have a manager or anyone older than us, more experienced. That's one of them saying that. Well, I think you did. What was it that I was doing? And I wrote, and it's just so glib, and it's just this underlying nasty personal spin thing. You know, I was faced with a choice back in the day, about 93, just after Got to Know. Do I stick with it and get some money, or do I just let it go? And I should have let it go. That was it. And was kind of ridiculous. That's just really unpleasant, and it's right across that whole history, which is why I haven't said anything until somebody's asked me about it.
That was when you stepped into Semi Lemon Colon?
Oh, well, that was happening towards the end all at the same time, right. You know, and then Thorazine Shuffle, I sort of took over stuff and managed to get them on through BMG, and we managed to get a couple of singles out, and I was hoping to, you know, something good to happen there. Well, we had some great success. The first single, Before Heaven, was pretty good. You know, it's a couple of thousand copies almost sold of that, and that's pretty good for that type of music, Before Heaven. Come on. Get a taste, then you know you'll touch the sound.
sure you're number one. Tie your arm and touch the sun. Tie your arm and touch the sun.
So I had this little fledgling label, if you will, and a licensing deal with BMG. BMG then took on all of the, we managed to get the Simulim Cola album out under the name Propeller, changed the name. Okay, probably a mistake. but, you know, we got that out through that and Thorazine Shuffle, and it was just like, I was just out of energy. I just couldn't. Oh, what happened? Oh, it just sort of things was just falling apart. It was just going rough. I do think we got on like the Tool support and we paid money to get on there and get traveling nationwide down to Christchurch and all that. And, you know, I'd ring the sales manager and he'd say, oh, is your album coming out this now? Oh, you better put it back. I'm on the road with Tool, mate. You know, we're just down here just trying to promote the album. Yeah, and no, I don't think we can really delay it. And there was just this lack of, I don't know, by that stage, BMG had every single label signed up, all of Murray Kamik stuff, all of that.
Yeah.
And it, when I sort of got in there with them, they had forgive me, they didn't really have anything, you know. That was just Supergroove came along and then Thorazine Shuffle, Your Own PR, which I think was a B-side to one of the singles. I should know.
To hide away, crawl up with the
I went to UK in 97.
Mm-hmm. And I take it once you got there, you weren't doing band management anymore.
No. I kind of looked at, I sort of made approaches and, you know, I went, I got a few interviews. I got to see that guy at MTV, you know, as people do. I made friends with Karen Hay doing the supergroup thing. She was on the floor of all of the early morning TV shows, and I got with and stayed friends with Karen and Andy, and helped him with a tour at one stage here, mm-hmm. and caught up with him in the UK, and I think she put me into touch with him, and then he put me into touch with all these other people, and it was like, oh, it was very interesting, and I got around to see head of this A&R, this stuff, and they said, didn't Kirk Harding do a great job of Supergroove? Partly, and I says, oh, yeah, probably, yeah. We did a great job of talking about himself.
You've travelled thousands of miles and here was this thing still haunting you.
Yeah, pretty much. So really, the same bunch of wankers wherever you go, and I'd had enough. Absolutely, you know, I tried to get a job there. I actually fell in with my uncle who works in the space industry, which is another. But he worked organising satellites onto rockets, you know, and it just takes a bit of a tangent there.
Wow.
And I worked with my uncle for 3 years, and I got to travel to Russia and stuff like this, and it was pretty interesting, pretty engaging. And I've since come back and did a degree in Russian and European studies and stuff like that, and it's just... A crazy little detour. I took on a 9-to-5 basically, and I can't say I enjoyed it much, but I got some money together, and I took on new things through it, and in that time I took up photography, and so that's what I'm doing now. So I did night school. I went to university there as in field. I did part of a degree thing in photography there, I just sort of had to stop all of this band nonsense, really. But no disrespect to whoever's left.
Yeah, whoever's still left.
And I got more into that management stuff, and I kind of was playing drums at the same time. And the band was Greg Fleming, who I have the utmost respect for as a songwriter. And I think it was alt country before sort of. A lot of alt country was sort of there. Maybe we were, ahead or behind of our times. But it was good. We got some gigs, and we kind of fell into a difficult market space there.
This is the trains.
Yeah, that's right. And it was Nick Kreisler who's put on bass with Pet Rocks nowadays, or back then and now again. John Segovia played later after me. Mark Peterson was on guitar for a while before the Straitjacket Fits poached him, and he went to them.
Yes.
And I'll never forgive Shane for that. Yeah, it was. I enjoyed that for a while, but it fell by the wayside.
Greg Fleming and the Trains. The track is called Mr. Clive.
Yes, it's time.
Been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society airs every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and is podcast later on in the week from BFM's website. This documentary is produced at BFM by Dubhead.
Don't get me started.